Hello and welcome to Guess That Record. I am your host, Jackson Reed. This is the show where we talk about music and try to figure out which album I pulled from my collection. This episode of Guess That Record was our second episode, and it originally released on April 6th, 2022. The guest is Canadian songwriting legend Jim Vallance. Jim is best known for his longtime collaboration with Bryan Adams, co-writing hit songs like Summer of 69, Run to You, and Heaven. Jim has also worked with artists such as Aerosmith, Glass Tiger, and Roger Daltrey. With all that being said, let's get into the interview.
Jim, how are you?
I'm well, thank you. Thanks for having me.
No problem. So you're in New York right now, is that correct?
I am.
Nice. How is it out there?
It's a beautiful sunny day. And if not for COVID, I would be looking forward to a show tonight or a concert or a restaurant or many of the things that New York has to offer. But despite what some people think, it's not over yet.
That's good to hear. Yeah. How long have you been in New York?
3 or 4 years.
Yeah, that was actually the last place I traveled to outside of Canada before COVID. So I would love to go back one day.
And what was your reason for your trip?
Well, I was actually on a tour. We did a little tour. It was like sort of a package tour through the South. So we played in Georgia and then finished up in Nashville. And me and my keyboard player just decided to go to New York for a few days. And yeah, it was really fun.
It's a real special place. It really is.
Definitely. Yeah. So to start things off, I always like to ask, what was the first album or song that made you take music seriously?
I'm not sure it was an album or a song per se, but, so 1964, I'm 11 years old in grade five, not interested in music particularly. It wasn't even on my radar. I had a couple of piano lessons, but, just, you know, I mean, my mom would have the radio on, but I wouldn't really pay attention. And then one night, one Sunday night, February 9th, 1964, I'm watching what was called the Ed Sullivan Show, which was on every Sunday night. It was kind of a family tradition. We'd all gather around the TV and watch the jugglers and comedians and whoever else was on. And on this particular night, the first act was, ladies and gentlemen, the Beatles. And I was like, what? It just absolutely gobsmacked me. These four odd looking guys, at the time, it's, you know, they were like aliens from another planet. So the first song they played was All My Lovin', and I was just mesmerized. So I guess that's the first song that really knocked my socks off. I didn't even know what song I was listening to, but a few days later, I got my mom to take me downtown and I bought the Beatles single, She Loves You. And I don't know if it was at the same time or not, but I also bought the Dave Clark 5 single, Glad All Over. So those are my first two purchases. And from that minute on until this very day, just music has been really just the focus of my life.
It's funny you talk about seeing the Beatles at 11, because that's when I discovered the Beatles, was when I was 11. I heard Paperback Writer, and to this day, it's still like probably the coolest sounding guitar I've ever heard. And that opened my door to, you know, be where I am musically today. So it's interesting how we were the same age, but, you know, like 40 years apart, basically.
Well, Paperback Writer, that guitar you're hearing is actually Paul McCartney. They cut right. That track with Paul on guitar, Ringo on drums. I'm not either George or John on guitar, I think, but it was. And then Paul overdubbed the bass later, but he played guitar. And the pictures I've seen from that session, I mean, you know, these days conventional wisdom is you isolate all the instruments, you don't want any leakage. He was sitting right in front of the drum kit, literally, like he and Ringo were like 2 feet apart when they did that track. So yeah, pretty amazing.
Yeah. And it's also funny because when I was in New York, when you're talking about the Ed Sullivan Show, I went to a taping of the Stephen Colbert Show, and it was kind of weird to think like, wow, this is where the Beatles did Ed Sullivan all those years ago.
I've not been, but I hear it's not a big room.
It's not. No, that was the other surprising thing is, yeah, it was pretty small. So you got your start professionally as the drummer for Prism. And it's funny because when I first read about you years ago, when I was starting to get into Bryan Adams, and I saw that you were in Prism, I was like, oh, hey, my dad has some of their tapes in the basement there. But have drums always been your main instrument?
Well, again, starting about the age of 11, after I saw the Beatles, I started begging my parents for a drum kit. That was what I wanted to do. I decided of the four Beatles, I wanted to be Ringo. And so it took a couple of years, but my parents finally gave in. I think it was Christmas 1965, I think, they bought me a guitar. And right around the same time, my grandmother bought me a used drum kit. So I started guitar and drums at the same time.
Right.
So, but then I'm a better drummer than I am a guitar player. So that was kind of the career path. I, you know, played in sort of weekend dance bands all through high school. And then into my 20s in Vancouver, there was a really vibrant club scene in the 70s. And so I was in various bands and we'd play like six nights a week, you know, Monday through Saturday. And that was my bread and butter for years and years. And then I got lucky enough to get into session work. So I would, you know, get up every morning, go to the studio and play on a McDonald's commercial or something. And then I'd get together with Bryan at lunchtime and we'd write until, I don't know, 9 o'clock. And then I'd go do play in a club. So I was, you know, working like, you know, 20 hours a day for a few years there. Just, there was so much going on.
Yeah. And so you mentioned Bryan, you guys kind of had like a chance meeting set up in about 1978. Is that correct?
Yeah. January 78. I just ran into him at Long and McQuaid in Vancouver.
Oh, nice.
And we had I was with a friend who knew him and she introduced us and we had a quick chat and decided to get together, which we did a couple of days later. And again, we never stopped to this day.
And what did you see in him at the time that made you think it was going to be a successful partnership?
He was 18 at the time, so and I was a few years older, but he just had that vibe that you could just tell he was hungry, tenacious. Until we actually got into a room together, I didn't realize how talented he was. He, you know, sang great, played great guitar, and we started writing songs together, and that clicked right away. So, I mean, I knew really early on that he was a force. You know, he was really talented, ambitious, and unstoppable. So we just right out of the gate we were just writing every day, like literally every day we got together.
And how do you two work together when you write songs? Like, does one guy sort of focus on the lyrics and the other guy does the music, or is it like an even workload?
It's an even thing, and it really depends. Like excuse me, a song like Heaven, I was sitting at the piano and Bryan was standing next to me and just kind of, you know, you just go fishing for chords and melodies and snippets of lyric and whatever, you know, you know how the process is. It's very random and just stuff pops up and you go, well, that sounds great. And you pop that in. And, you know, so with that song, I played piano, he sang. I'm trying to think, Cuts Like a Knife. I think he was playing guitar and I was playing bass while we were writing that. And I used to like playing bass sometimes when we wrote, because it put me a little bit in the driver's seat, because, you know, you can play a G on the bass and then Bryan can play a G on guitar, but I can move that up to a C on the bass. And even if he doesn't change the chord, I've forced it to go somewhere. And sometimes it's even a really cool kind of juxtaposition. I might play a bass note that has no business being part of that chord, but it's like, whoa, that's cool. You know, so, and then sometimes we'd both be playing guitar. So it was really different every time.
Right. And it's funny going back to the Beatles, because every time I've sort of read about how a Beatles song was written, Paul, for example, would always be like, well, you know, I wrote most of that one, but John did the bridge. That was his bit. So are there songs that you and Bryan have done where you can point out like something that was totally yours, like Run to You, for example? What's something in that song that you came up with?
I mean, that might be the worst example because that was such a collaborative thing. Well, we started with the riff, you know, the da 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 da. I mean, I'm trying to remember. We were trying to write a song for Blue Oyster Cult, and their song, "Don't Fear the Reaper," is a riff song, you know. Mm-hmm. So I'm trying to remember. I can't remember how we started. It was nothing at all like. It was nothing like that. It started off somewhere completely different. And just, we just sat across from each other and I would play something and then Brian would play something and we just ended up there. Sorry, I should be able to play it better than that. But so it was very collaborative, that song.
Yeah. And it's, for those listening there, Jim brought out his guitar to play the riff to Run to You there. So that was cool.
Poorly.
And the commercial peak that you guys had with the Reckless album, which I've got right here, and I like that they put your picture there on the sleeve.
Yeah, that was nicer than, wasn't it?
Yeah. And you know, the commercial peak that you guys had with that album is the stuff that most artists dream about. It was number one record in both Canada and the US. And in the US, Heaven reached the top of the Billboard Hot 100. And I think that's the most impressive part for you. You know, there are artists like Bruce Springsteen and Bob Dylan and The Who and Jimi Hendrix who never had a number one song. So you've got those guys beat there. What did you think of the success of that album at the time it came out?
Well, it's thrilling. I mean, it's kind of what you hope would happen. You know, as a songwriter and as an artist for Brian, you want to have hits, and number one is kind of the, you can't get any higher than that. So, Brian was touring at the time. It was I guess it was 84. I don't remember the exact date. You might know better than I when the album went to number one or when the single went to number one. But Brian was out on the road with his band. I was back in Vancouver. And we just were watching the charts. It would come out, Billboard would release the numbers every Tuesday, once a week. So we would see number 89, and the next week it'd be number 64, and the next week number 32. And we just saw it climbing up the charts. And you go, wow, do you think we can make it all the way to number one? And I mean, there was a lot of competition back then. There was a lot of really good music on that radio. So, and we just kept watching it. So I finally, when it got up to around number nine or eight or something, I was talking to Brian on the phone. This is before email even. This is, you know, before the internet. And I said, look, if it goes to number one, I'll fly to wherever you are and we'll celebrate. And where was it? It was Cincinnati, I think. So I flew out and we had a little celebration at the hotel, and it was thrilling, of course, absolutely. Mm-hmm. It's what you hope for.
For sure. And so yeah, you guys had that success, and then you had a very long period where you didn't work together. The last album you were credited on for a long time was Waking Up the Neighbors, where you got the co-writing nod on songs like Depend on Me. And those songs had been written before Brian had started working with Mutt Lange.
Yeah, kind of. Depend on Me started off as a different song that Brian and I had co-written, and then Mutt came in, and like your thing you said a minute ago about Paul would write something and then John would come in and write the middle eight. That's what they used to call a bridge back in those days. So yeah, Mutt took some things that Brian and I had started and added his bits to it. So that's how there ended up being some three-way splits, me and Brian and Mutt. But, you know, like I said, from January 78 until August 89, and I remember it was August 89 because that's just after my son was born, Brian and I pretty much spent, you know, 7 days a week, 12 hours a day together, unless he was touring. We were in a room with no windows, sitting across from each other, you know, for countless hours. And I don't care who you are. That's at some point, that's going to, you know, if you're, you know, imagine being taken hostage by terrorists and they put you and somebody in a cell, you know, I mean, you know, for a couple of, well, for 10 years, you know, you're going to start to get on each other's nerves. So I think Brian and I just kind of burned out, you know, I think we should have taken a break. In fact, I think I suggested to him that we take a break because we were in the middle of writing in August 89. We were in the middle of writing or towards the end of writing. Into the Fire had already been done. Yeah, I guess we were on to Waking Up the Neighbors. And we just burned out, you know, we just totally burned out. So Brian didn't want to take a break. So I said, you know, I'm taking a break. Mm-hmm. And you know, it was a little testy. It didn't end on a really happy note. And for, I forget how many years, 5 or 10 years, we didn't work together. You know, I went and worked with Aerosmith and Alice Cooper and other people, and Brian continued on with Mutt. And then it just kind of, you know, we were brothers, you know, it just kind of drifted back together at some point, started talking and then sending each other some ideas. By this time there was email, you know, if Brian had a song idea, he'd send it over and see if I had anything to contribute and vice versa. And then we just started writing it together again. So, you know, it was a difficult decade, but I think it was necessary. And I think we came back closer as a result.
Yeah. And I was going to say, it's cool. You guys were able to sort of get back together writing again. And, you know, you guys made a record with Jeff Lynne here in the last few years.
Yeah, that was a load of fun.
And you wrote the Pretty Woman musical together. Did your long hiatus of writing with Brian change the way you work together, or was it just sort of like old times again?
Yeah, I don't think we ever had a way of working together particularly, you know? So, and again, it was just different every time. Every time we sat down to write a song, it was, you know, a different approach, different methods even. So we didn't have a formula. So, you know, we just kind of picked up where we left off. And I mean, unless you have a template or something like the Pretty Woman musical, you know, we were working to an existing script and storyline, which really informed our lyric writing, obviously, because we had to stay true to the story. So when you have something like that, then it's kind of, not imposes, but it kind of dictates where you're going to go with, especially with the lyrics. Mm-hmm. And style-wise, also with the Pretty Woman musical, the director would want a rock song for this section and a ballad for that section. So, you know, we're working to some degree to some set instructions, but, you know, we had a lot of free rein too. But if we were just sitting down to write a song for Brian, and I'm not sure we necessarily did that, because we'd just write and then we'd go, maybe that's not right for Brian, and we'd give it to Tina Turner or something. So we were just writing to write. Mm-hmm. And I guess Brian, even like Run to You, after Blue Oyster Cult turned it down, it just went on the shelf. Brian had no interest in it. And it was his producer, Bob Clearmount, towards the end of the Reckless sessions said, look, we're at least a song short here. What else you got? And Brian has said, well, I got this song Run to You, but I don't really like it. And he played it for Bob. And Bob said, I think it's great. I think we should cut it. And that's how it ended up on the album. So yeah, we were never sure what song was going to work for Brian.
Mm-hmm. And Brian has got his new So Happy It Hurts album coming out fairly soon. I wanted to know, did you contribute anything to it? I noticed he's working with Mutt again.
Yeah, I've got 3 songs on it. So I think he wrote, I haven't heard the whole album. I think he's got some songs with Mutt, some songs with Gretchen Peters, and I know that I've got 3 songs, so.
Nice. That's good to hear there. One thing I wanted to spend some time talking about was your role in this here, Tears Are Not Enough.
Oh yeah, okay.
Which was, for those who don't know, was Canada's answer to We Are the World and Do They Know It's Christmas. I was reading about your involvement on the song through your website, jimvalance.com, which has some great reading if anyone's interested to learn more about the songs you've worked on. And it was kind of a random encounter that you had with David Foster that got you involved in the project.
Yeah, well, as I mentioned earlier, in the 80s, I was doing a lot of session work, commercials for, you know, various products, radio and TV commercials, as a drummer. So on that particular day, I was at Little Mountain Sound Studio in Vancouver, and Little Mountain had two studios, Studio A and Studio B, but there was a common lobby. So I was sitting in the lobby between sessions, and David Foster came out of Studio B. My session was in Studio A. He came out of Studio B, like looked like, I don't know, he'd just seen aliens or something. He was very like agitated and like looked around like, said, Jim, you have a studio, right, in your house? I said, yeah. He goes, okay, we need to write something. I just got off the phone with Quincy Jones, and he wants a song from Canada for African famine relief. When can I come over? I went, okay, I don't know, tonight? So Brian was actually out on tour, due back the next day, I think. So David and I got together that night at my home studio and started working on what would eventually be Tears Are Not Enough. And then Brian came back from the tour the next day, and he hurried over when he heard we were doing some stuff, and he jumped in. And we wrote a song. And that was, we finished it, I think we finished it on a Sunday and in Vancouver. And the next Sunday, we were in Toronto recording it. And somehow between, in those 7 days, Brian's manager, Bruce Allen, managed to get, you know, Joni Mitchell, Oscar Peterson, John Candy, Geddy Lee. I mean, it was absolutely amazing what came together in a very, very short period of time.
And another fact that I found amazing, just from reading sort of the process of how you came together with the song, was that the master track was just the demo that you and David made.
For the most part, yeah, we cut a track in my home studio and kept most of it. I mean, you know, and then we overdubbed drums at Little Mountain Sound, and Paul Dean added some guitar. But yeah, quite a bit of what was recorded in my home studio ended up being the bed mm-hmm. track for the song.
And when you guys were putting the song together, did you know who you wanted to sing each line? Like, how was that determined?
Oh, we had that once we knew who was coming. In fact, we did it on the plane, on the flight from Vancouver to Toronto. Me and Brian and Mike Reno, I think, from Loverboy, sat with the lyric and kind of went, okay, why don't we have Gordon Lightfoot sing the first line, and we've got Burton Cummins to sing the second. It was pretty fun just putting that list together.
Now, what was the session like having all those big names in one place?
It was pretty cool. I mean, again, you know, no matter how much success I've had in my career, I'm still just a kid and a fan and with gaga about my heroes. So for me, it was like being in the same room as Joni Mitchell and Neil Young and, you know, Burton Cummings and, you know, my heroes from, you know, my teens and 20s. I mean, it was quite overwhelming. It was, and you know, some guys from the band, and I mean, it was just amazing. You know, it really was.
I'm always sort of interested in learning about recording techniques, especially from back in the day when everything was done on tape and you didn't have an unlimited number of tracks to work with. So, you know, there's a lot going on, especially with the vocals in this song. So how was the song sort of split up in that regard?
I'm trying to think back now. In those days, it was 24 track machines, and this is before digital. So it was 24 track analog. And I think we did a mix to two tracks. So we kept the 24 tracks with instruments on it, and then we did a mix to two tracks of another 24 machine. So we had the band track in stereo on, say, tracks 1 and 2, and that left open, like, you know, 22 tracks, although take away a track for code, which was used to sync the machines. So we had another 20 or 21 tracks for vocals. So, and also because other than the big backing vocals, you know, the choruses, everyone kind of sang one line. So we could have Gordon Lightfoot on track two, and the next line would be whoever, I'd have to again look back.
Burton Cummings, I think, was after.
Cummings. We could have him on the next track. And then we could go back to the Gordon Lightfoot track a little bit later with no risk of erasing his vocal. You know, so we could sort of have Gordon and other people on other tracks. So yeah, it was a little bit of a you know, figuring out ahead of time how it was all going to work. It was engineered by a guy named Hayward Parrott, who, you know, very experienced engineer. So he knew exactly what he was doing. So we just kind of left that in his
right
realm. Yeah.
And another crazy aspect that you oversaw was getting Bruce Coburn's part into the song. And for those that don't know what happened there, like, what did you have to do to get Bruce into the song?
Yeah, I forgot about that. Thanks for reminding me. So, I mean, Bruce Coburn was, you know, for a bunch of reasons, I mean, you know, well-loved kind of Canadian folk artist and socially active. And we just thought it would be great to have him involved. And unfortunately, he was on tour in Germany at the time and couldn't do it. So someone said, the only way we could do it is if somebody flies over there and we book a studio and record him. I mean, nowadays, he could have just sung his line into his iPhone and emailed it to us. But you have to remember, this is before the internet,
yeah,
before digital. This is analog. So silly me, I said, well, I'll go over, you know, I'll go do it. So so I was in Vancouver. So what they did is I had to take a tape with me to Germany and then book a studio and go in with the tape and get Bruce's vocal on the tape and then bring the tape back. So I flew from, the good news is Air Canada, because we're doing this for charity, Air Canada offered to give us free flights, but the free flights were kind of like not direct. So I flew from Vancouver to Toronto, picked up the tape from Hayward, the engineer. Then I flew from Toronto to Frankfurt, and Bruce was in...
Wasn't it Hamburg?
Hamburg, yep. Then I flew from Frankfurt to Hamburg and I arrived around dinner time and Bruce was playing a gig that night in a small venue. And I got together with Bruce and Bruce says, so tell me about this project. I went, oh, well, it's like Canadian contribution to famine relief. Like, you know, like We Are the World and Do They Know It's Christmas? And he said, well, I don't really know if I want to be involved. And I went, what? I just flew halfway around the world. I think, I forget, it was something like 16, with layovers, it was something like 16 or 18 hours of flying, Vancouver to Toronto, Toronto to Frankfurt, Frankfurt to Hamburg. Anyway, before I reached for Bruce's neck with my claws, we had a further chat about it and he came around and agreed to do it. I don't know if he was ever not going to do it. He just kind of had a moment there where he was like, you know, I'm not really sure. Anyway, the next day we went in the studio, Bruce sang beautifully, now had his voice on tape. So they were mixing the next day in Los Angeles. Umberto Gatica was mixing at Lion's Share Studio in LA. So I'm in Hamburg. So the next morning I get up, I fly from Hamburg to Frankfurt. Frankfurt to, I had to Vancouver or Toronto, I forget which, because I had to pick up the tape, the master tape, I think, to bring with me. So yeah, I think I flew to Toronto, picked up the tape, and then I guess I flew from Toronto to LA. And by this time I hadn't slept for about 3 days. Maybe an hour or something. I mean, and I remember getting out of the car. It was really embarrassing. At LA airport, David Foster picked me up. And I remember coming off the plane and my legs gave out. I actually fell down, kind of collapsed from exhaustion. And I mean, I was okay, but it was just that I just totally fried myself doing this Bruce Coburn, like 5 seconds of vocal. But anyway, we went to the studio, flew his vocal into the master tape, and then Umberto did a, you know, outstanding job of stitching it all together.
And it must have been such an amazing project to be a part of, working with all those big names and raising money for a good cause. And I remember hearing the song for the first time when I was in high school, because I was really into Rush at that time. And I was like, oh, hey, Geddy's on it. And he's got, I think, one of the best lines on the song there. And it's also funny, my mom and I have talked about the song, and she thinks it's better than We Are the World.
Oh, well, tell your mom thank you.
Yeah, yeah. And quickly, I wanted to ask you about the songs you wrote for Roger Daltrey, because I'm a huge fan of The Who. So I wanted to know what it was like to write some songs for him.
Well, great. Brian knew Roger. Brian's girlfriend at the time, Vicki Russell, was the daughter of Ken Russell, who directed the film, was it Quadrophenia or... what film am I thinking of? What film was Tommy? Sorry, Tommy, directed Tommy, and Vicky, as a little girl, was in the film. So Vicky knew Roger, and I think Vicky introduced Brian to Roger, and they went out for dinner one night, and Roger was doing an album, and Brian said, "Hey, you know, if you need some songs," so we wrote we did two songs for Roger. One was a song we already had kicking around. I think we'd written it for Stevie Nicks. It was called Let Me Down Easy. I think we wrote it for Stevie Nicks, but either she didn't do it or we never even got it to her in the first place. And then the second song, called Rebel, we wrote especially for Roger. We kind of imagined from his point of view, I don't think Roger writes songs, but we imagined if he could, what would he want to say? And just imagined this English guy in a small town with a kind of a crappy job and just wanting to get out of there, you know, and being a little bit of a rebel, just, you know, everyone else in his town just stayed. So the song Rebel kind of came from, here's a guy who has decided, I might've been born here, but I'm not going to die here, you know,
right.
And he, like a rebel, I'm out of here.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, it's a great song. So. All right. Jim, we are now moving into the portion of this podcast for which it gets its name. I'll go over the rules for you and any new listeners out there. So I have a bag here, and inside this bag is a record that I picked from my collection of nearly 400 albums. I will give you 3 clues about that album to steer you in the right direction. And then you can ask me 15 yes or no questions to determine the identity of the album. Just as an extra tip, you can absolutely right off the bat ask questions like, is it Purple Rain? But if all your questions are like that, you may run out of them. So, Jim Valance, are you ready to guess that record?
I am.
All right, here are your 3 clues. This album was released in the 1970s. It features 3 singles that reached the top spot of the Billboard Hot 100, and this record was not released when it was supposed to be. Question 1.
Is it Canadian?
It's not Canadian. Question 2.
Is it a band or an artist?
It is a band. Question 3.
Is it an American band?
It's not an American band. Question 4.
Is it a British band?
It is a British band. Question 5.
Is it a 3-piece band?
It's not a 3-piece band. Question 6.
Is there a woman in the band?
There is not. Question 7.
Is it progressive rock?
It's not progressive rock. If you need any hints, I'm happy to give you an extra hint.
Well, yeah, I'm going to need some hints because I'm not even close.
Okay, I'll say that we have talked about this band already in this podcast.
Okay.
Question 8.
Is it The Who?
It's not The Who. Question 9.
I talked about this band already. Oh, you know, my memory's really good, but it's short. Is it a band I've written for?
No. Question 10.
Is it the Rolling Stones?
It's not the Rolling Stones, but they're just as legendary.
Oh, okay. It's Get Back by the Beatles.
Jim Vallance, you are correct. The record I pulled from the collection was Let It Be.
Let It Be, yeah. Now called Get Back, I guess.
Yeah.
The new version of it. It wasn't released when it was supposed to be. I should have got that clue, because it was recorded in 69.
Mm-hmm.
And then Abbey Road was recorded and released. And then after that, they released Let It Be.
Exactly, yes. Yeah. So, and I thought it would be a very topical choice because there's the new Get Back documentary that just released on Disney Plus. Quickly, though, I'm going to give some fast facts about Let It Be for those who haven't heard the album. It was released on May 8th, 1970, about a month after the Beatles broke up. Despite topping the charts in the US, UK, and Canada, the album was very polarizing at the time of its release, coming to be regarded as one of the most controversial albums of all time. As I mentioned in the clues, the album had three songs that reached number one: the title track, Get Back, and The Long and Winding Road. So, just sort of continuing our Beatles discussion here, I noticed on your website that you've got some cool Beatles memorabilia.
I do.
Yeah, the John Lennon visa, I believe, was the one I saw there. How did, what's the story behind that?
Well, the story behind the visa itself is in August 1960, the Beatles, who were still teenagers, I don't think John had even turned 19 yet in August. Yeah, he wasn't yet 19. Paul would have been 18, George 17. Ringo hadn't joined the band yet. They went to Hamburg to play in some clubs there. And this, in order to do that, they had to have some German paperwork for permission to work in Germany. So this is like 18 pages that spans the time they were in Germany, which is from 1960 through June 62. And each time they went over there, they had to do more paperwork. So I have all the visas and passport photos and things that John's permission to work in Germany.
That's incredible. Yeah. If I can ever become a successful musician and have lots of money, I would love to like buy an album that's signed by the four of them. I'd love to collect something like that. Now moving back to Let It Be, it has a very weird timeline, as we were talking about. The majority of songs were written and recorded in January of 1969, but the project was put on the shelf. They went and made Abbey Road, which is actually the last album they did together. And it's also odd because it doesn't really have a producer. Glyn Johns oversaw the sessions in 1969, but Phil Spector then had the task of putting together those recordings a year later in 1970. And the group's longtime producer, George Martin, was also involved in the sessions. What was your initial impression of the album when you first heard it?
Well, I mean, every new Beatle album was just such a gift. I think my impression, because Abbey Road was such a slick album, it was, you know, just beautifully produced with strings and the arrangements were fleshed out and, you know, lots of beautiful backing vocals overdubbed and so on. I mean, we didn't know at the time that Let It Be had been recorded before Abbey Road, because it came out after. So as far as we knew, it was just the next album after Abbey Road. I remember as a fan back then, I would have been maybe 18 when Abbey Road came out. Sorry, when Let It Be came out. Just thinking it was a little unpolished, but it was supposed to be. That was the whole idea. You know, even though Phil Spector kind of put his kind of fairy dust on it with some strings and overdubs and so on. For the most part, it was still just the band, you know, playing live without much embellishment. So I think initially I found it a little, excuse me, underproduced. But then, of course, as time goes by, you realize that was how it was intended to be. And then I saw the film around the same time, too. It was released, I think, in 1970 or not long after the first edit of the film. And then over time, it just grows on you because the songs are so good, you know, Let It Be and Get Back and so on.
Yeah. And so, yeah, the other fascinating aspect about the album was that it was originally going to do a live TV special at Twickenham Film Studios where they would play these new songs, but they were really against the clock because they had 3 weeks to do it all because Ringo was going to go film a movie. And they were being rehearsed they were being filmed while they were rehearsing. And it captures a lot of the tension that they were going through at the time. And then they scrapped the TV special and the film director, Michael Lindsay Hogg, was then had to sort of turn it into a documentary of the band making this album. And they moved to a makeshift studio at the Apple Record headquarters on Savile Row, where they properly recorded the new songs. And then to sort of have a big finale for this documentary, they went up on the roof and played some songs, which of course was their final appearance in public. Final performance in public, I should say. And as you mentioned, the original documentary came out in May of 1970 as well, and it was poorly received by critics and the band. But Peter Jackson has taken all that footage and put it in as sort of a new cut of this documentary that's almost 8 hours long. So have you had the chance to see this new one yet?
I have.
What did you think of it?
Well, I mean, I thought it could have been maybe 3 hours. Have you seen it?
Yeah.
Yeah. The moments like when you literally see the song Get Back
being written,
just come out of thin air. There's a moment where the song doesn't exist and 2 seconds later it does. As Paul just kind of conjures it out of thin air. I mean, that sort of stuff was amazing. Seeing them doing serious rehearsal in preparation for the rooftop concert. But there was hours and hours of just them being silly, you know? And as much fun as it was to see that, how about we just get 20 minutes of that and then get on with it? I just found the goofing around way overused. And I'm left wondering, okay, if it was going to be 8 hours, you know, if they had taken out the goofiness, was there more of that, you know, the moment Let It Be came into being, or the moment, you know, each song kind of appeared? Mm-hmm. I would have enjoyed seeing more of the creative process and the serious rehearsing rather than all the sort of just goofing around.
And yeah, I could see someone that's not a fan of the band maybe be kind of like bored watching it. But I mean, because it's the Beatles, and there's just like, there's barely any footage of them sort of working like this. It's very fascinating. And it's interesting you talk about seeing things that maybe didn't get put in the final product. I saw an interview with Peter Jackson where he was talking about there was a performance they did of One After 909 in the studio that was really good, but he left it out because it was in the rooftop performance shortly after that. So it was sort of stuff like that. But it is interesting watching them write together because it feels like if you've been in a band, that's what it's like when you're writing songs with other people. And it's sort of relatable to see like, wow, this is the biggest band in the world, but they still, you know, are just a band at the end of the day. And it doesn't shy away from the tension that the band was going through. Because it shows the exact moment where George quits the band, which is kind of crazy to see. Now, the other interesting thing I think that helps sort of change the narrative of the story is that you see a lot of Glyn Johns, because I didn't even really know he was involved in the sessions. I thought it was Phil Spector doing it. But then you see that Phil Spector isn't even in this documentary. Glyn Johns is the guy recording all these songs. So I think that kind of gives him some props there.
Yeah, well, they dumped it on him. After they decided to abandon the project, they dumped it on Glyn Johns and said, here, you make something of this. And he took it to Olympic Studios and did a mix, which they, I think it's a mix that McCartney preferred. It might even be what was called the naked mix.
Right.
But they ultimately weren't happy with that either. So John Lennon gave it to Phil Spector and dumped it on him and said, here, you see if you can do something with it. So Spector, put strings and choirs and all kinds of things on some of the songs.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the album that was released and that we were most familiar with in the 70s.
Yeah.
Glyn gets credit for certainly recording the album. And, mm-hmm. and you know, I think he's to this day a little bummed that his mix didn't become the definitive version. But
now I figured we could just go through it track by track here and you can chime in whenever you have something to say. But it starts off with Two of Us, which is a nice little acoustic number. And we see in the documentary that the track really goes through a lengthy process to sort of end up with the one that we hear on the album. And it kind of reminds me of some songs that Paul would later do with Wings, like Another Day or songs like that. Then Dig a Pony was one of the songs that was recorded on the roof, and that one also kind of went through some changes to get there. Across the Universe is probably one of my favorite Beatles songs of all time. There's something just so profound to me. And it was one of the songs that Phil Spector messed around with and added strings and stuff. And having heard both versions, I think I actually kind of prefer it with the orchestra on it. But that's one of the songs that really got Spectored. Then I, Me, Mine was one of the Harrison penned songs. And we see in the documentary, like the moment when George writes the song, but it was unfinished in those initial sessions. And it got properly recorded in January of 1970 by George, Paul, and Ringo, which made it one of the last, or I think it was the last new song ever recorded by the group. Then we've got the title track, Let It Be, which is sandwiched in between Dig It and Maggie May, which are kind of filler tracks. But Let It Be, of course, you know, one of their most famous songs. I've Got a Feeling and One After 909 are the other two songs from the Rooftop concert that made it on the album. I really like I've Got a Feeling. I think that's an underrated song. And One After 909 is interesting because it was a song they did in their early days.
Yes,
which is it's kind of a theme of the album, and you see that a lot in the documentary where they're kind of playing some of their older tracks. Then we have The Long and Winding Road, which is one of their strongest ballads and the last number one hit. And I think this was a song that really angered Paul McCartney when Phil Spector put the orchestra on it.
Yeah.
The album then ends with another Harrison song, For You Blue, and then it ends with Get Back, which is probably one of the best rock and roll songs of all time.
So good.
And I can see why people may not consider it their best, but I've always enjoyed it ever since I was a kid. And, I think since a big point of the album is that the band wasn't keen on sort of how the songs ended up, what do you think of the production on songs like the Long and Winding Road?
I mean, the first version I heard of it was the Spector production. So that was kind of the one that was implanted, you know, in my brain. But I kind of have to agree with Paul, too, that there's something about just the unadorned version that's very, very endearing, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So and you have to wonder, like these songs, any one of these songs could have made it through to the Abbey Road album.
Yeah.
You know, they worked on Bathroom Window and
Something. Oh Darling, Octopus's Garden. Yeah, there was a lot of songs they did that ended up on Abbey Road.
So any one of these songs could have made it through to Abbey Road. And you have to wonder what what they would have sounded like if they had got the full treatment, you know, four Beatles plus George Martin plus plus Jeff Emerick. Although even Abbey Road, the first bit of Abbey Road, they finished, obviously, in January 69, they finished the Get Back recordings, and it wasn't too long after, April or May, they started work on Abbey Road. I think the first thing, I Want You, She's So Heavy, I think is the first thing they recorded. Mm-hmm. It was actually recorded at, started at Trident Studio, not at EMI Studio. And Glenn Johns was the engineer on that. So he and Billy Preston was on it. So they kind of took the Glenn Johns, Billy Preston thing and carried it over into the first bits of Abbey Road. And then Jeff Emerick came back in for the rest of the album.
Yeah.
And the mixing.
And it's interesting when watching the documentary, how much the sessions change over the course of that month, because they start at Twickenham and it's very bad for the band. And you can just tell they're not happy there. And the songs are quite off too. The whole time you're like, how are they going to end up with the finished product? And it's amazing how much the tone shifts when they move to Apple. And it changes even more when Billy Preston shows up. Like the first song he plays on is I've Got a Feeling. And right away I was like, oh yeah, that's it.
Yeah, it's magic.
It's kind of reminds me of like when they were making the White Album and they were at each other the whole time. And then George brings in Eric Clapton to do While My Guitar Gently Weeps, and they all got on their best behavior again. It's also funny with Billy because they knew him in their Hamburg days. And with the whole theme of the album being like a return to the roots, it was kind of interesting to see that come full circle and have a guy from Hamburg playing on these songs.
He was only 16 when they first met him. Playing in Little Richard's band.
Yeah, that's crazy. It's also fun to watch the rooftop concert, which is shown in its entirety in the documentary. I think it proved the band could still absolutely play great live. And it made me wonder, like, what would have happened if they did the TV special or did a concert like they were planning. And it shows the reaction from the crowd and the police. And it's interesting to see the contrast of the look of the band with the people in the crowd. Like they're the only ones with long hair and flashy clothes. It's sort of
true,
interesting.
Yeah.
And another thing that I think would surprise people with the rooftop concert is that they only got three songs out of it on the record. They kind of trick you into thinking Get Back and Don't Let Me Down were recorded on the roof as well, but those were done in the studio. And actually on the back here of the album, it says, this is a new phase Beatle album. Essential to the content of the film Let It Be was that they performed live for many tracks. Comes with the warmth and the freshness of a live performance as reproduced for disc by Phil Spector. But I mean, yeah, there's really, if we're talking like true live songs, there's really only three on the record.
Yeah.
Now, lastly, I just want to ask you, have you met any of the Beatles?
I've met, Ringo three times and Paul three times. Yes.
Wow. What were those like? What were those meetings?
Well, it was, I mean, again, as a fan, it's just, it's magical, you know? The very first time I met Ringo was in Vancouver. He and Harry Nilsson came up to Vancouver to do some recording. And the next time I met him was also in Vancouver. He was rehearsing with one of his bands for his All-Star Tour. And the third time was at Mark Hudson's studio in Los Angeles. And then Paul, I met him backstage in Brooklyn when he was doing a concert there first time. And then the second time, he and I stood side by side, side stage, Hyde Park for a Jeff Lynne concert.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
The third time, I'm trying to remember where the third time was. Might even have met him four times, but yeah, I mean, and they're both lovely guys, Paul and Ringo, just really, really sweet, generous with their time. I think they know you're freaking out, you know, and they kind of go out of their way to make you feel okay.
Yeah, no, that's, if I could meet both of them one day, that would be amazing for sure. Well, we've reached the end of the episode. I want to once again thank Jim Vallance for being the guest of honor today. You've done so much amazing work that I admire greatly. And there's just not enough time to go over everything you've done in your career in a single podcast. But I thank you very much for coming on.
It was my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much for tuning in to that amazing episode of Guess That Record. Feel free to check us out on social media. You can find us on Instagram, TikTok, and YouTube. And we have the same username across all three platforms, at Guess That Record. You can also check out our website, www.guessthatrecordpodcast.com. Remember to keep rocking, and we'll see you on the next episode of Guess That Record.